Declara abierta la tercera sesión del noveno periodo de sesiones del Foro Permanente para las Cuestiones Indígenas. Distinguidos miembros del Foro, como parte de su examen del tema 7 del programa titulado Labor Futura del Foro Permanente, incluidas las cuestiones relacionadas con el Consejo Económico y Social y nuevas cuestiones estatal del Foro Permanente, celebrará un debate de mediodía de duración sobre los pueblos indígenas y los bosques. Pasaremos ahora al debate de grupo sobre los pueblos indígenas y los bosques. Los integrantes del grupo harán declaraciones introductorias y posteriormente daré la palabra a otros oradores. Desearía dar la bienvenida a esta reunión a los distinguidos miembros del grupo y presentarlos. Señora ministra María Teresa Mezquita de Pessoa, de la Fundación Nacional Brasileña sobre Cuestiones Indígenas, FUNAI. Señor Jan MacAlpin, directora secretaria del Foro de las Naciones Unidas sobre los Bosques. Señora Victoria Tauli Corpus, miembro del Foro Permanente. A quienes ruego me acompañen al podio. La señora Jana MacAlpin, ¿quién es? La primera oradora de la lista es la señora Jan MacAlpin, directora secretaria del Foro de las Naciones Unidas sobre los Bosques, quien hará una declaración en nombre de su organización. Señora MacAlpin, tiene usted la palabra.
Gracias. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to be here with you. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to be here. You might notice I'm wearing unconventional Western dress, but that's because the first 19 years of my life, I lived in Africa. And I feel most at home in this dress, and I thought this was perhaps one forum that would very much appreciate that fact. I serve the United Nations Forum on Forests as the director of the Secretariat, and I'm not sure how much you know about it, but I would like to talk a little bit about the context, and I appreciate Mr. Chairman being the first panelist. I'm going to maybe set a little bit of the context for forests, for those of you who are not familiar, although I know that most of you here in this room have done a great deal of work on forests and indigenous peoples. And one message I'm going to be giving you repeatedly is that we wish to hear from you about what you see as the priorities in forests for indigenous peoples. As you may know, the forest area, according to FAO, is about 4 billion hectares, approximately 30.3% of total land area. 1.6 billion people depend in one way or another on forests for their livelihoods, their sustenance, or in some way are dependent on forests. That's a pretty significant percentage of the world's population that requires it as their livelihoods or as their culture or their spiritual value. And the fact of the matter is, It also provides ecosystem services as well for other populations in the countries, and it is especially important for the rural poor and local communities, apart from your own groups, the indigenous peoples. Of about 60 million people, and another 350 million people are highly dependent. Sorry, this is a bit garbled on this point. Apologies. But another aspect of this, as you are aware, is that, of course, forests have a significant economic importance. And there are a number of issues to be dealt with in that regard. I want to highlight for you that working with forests requires that we value all of the benefits that forests provide to us. It's not only the economic values, of course. In fact, in some ways, the environmental, spiritual, and cultural sometimes are more important to populations than the economic. And this is an aspect that the forum is going to be dealing with next year, and I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about that. I want to give you a little bit of context for what the United Nations Forum on Forests, we have the shared name of forum in our title, has done on this subject. But I'm going back a little bit before to our own shared history, where, of course, in 1992 at the Rio Conference, Agenda 21 recognized the critical role of forests, including stakeholder, major groups, and including indigenous peoples in their role in sustainable development, as you know, and you have done work related to this. Then in the mid-1990s, in the forest process, which occurred in headquarters in the United Nations in the context of the Commission on Sustainable Development, the Intergovernmental Panel on Forests started to address the issues, substantive issues related to indigenous groups, and to provide a vehicle to start discussing how indigenous peoples could have a strong voice. To the present, we actually have had a small but very active major group participation from indigenous peoples. I was looking around this room to see if I recognize anyone from the forum that I work with, and I only see two or three people that I've worked with in the United Nations Forum on Forests. And so one thing I want to say right off is I'm here in part at your invitation, but clearly with a message from the United Nations Forum on Forests, can we work together on our areas of shared interest? Because this room of people, if we had your advice, your help, the United Nations Forum on Forests could be far more effective in doing what it needs to do with respect to this issue. And we would very much like to have your role. In the United Nations Forum on Forest discussions, there's a big body of work. I can't bore you all with all of the details. I invite you to go to our website and look at papers, and I can provide anybody who wants some more information. But the UNFF does recognize very clearly the critical role of indigenous peoples in sustainable forest management. It's repeatedly identified as a major forest policy issue. And for a long time, as you can imagine, as you've had to deal with yourself, it was a somewhat sensitive issue. But with time, a respect and understanding of indigenous peoples and their role in forests has developed in the forum. I'm highlighting a couple of issues here: respecting customary and traditional rights, protecting the rights and privileges related to what the forum refers to as traditional forest-related knowledge, and the acronym is TFRK, but don't have to worry about learning it. But the traditional forest-related knowledge, and as it relates to forest biological resources, has been, since the mid-90s, a major discussion in the forum and its predecessor bodies. In 2007, we made a leap forward. The 192 member states of the United Nations Forum on Forests reached an agreement. We refer to it as the Forest Instrument. Otherwise, it has the very unwieldy name of the non-legally binding instrument on all types of forests. You can see why I try not to use that term. The Forest Instrument focuses in particular, among other things, on the strong link between forests and people. And in that relation, again, it picks up and elaborates on traditional forest-related knowledge, fair and equitable sharing of benefits, the enabling environments which would allow indigenous communities to participate as equal partners in sustainable forest management, and specifically recognizes the need to access to forest resources and markets to support the livelihoods of indigenous communities. Now, as I've already said, we cannot, first of all, the United Nations Forum on Forests is not an implementing body, but we are here to help gain recognition in forests around the world for the importance of, in this instance, the role and contributions of indigenous peoples. And we very much welcome this forum's expertise and contribution to our body of work. Now, I want to particularly raise for you today that the upcoming forum meeting, United Nations Forum on Forests meeting, will take place in January and February of 2011, this coming January and February, here in New York. The theme, and partly why I'm here today, is Forests for People, Livelihoods, and Poverty Eradication. We've been given some guidance back in 2007 on the need to identify and work on community-based forest management issues, social development, indigenous issues, and other local and forest-dependent communities, including the subject of forest land tenure, which I think has evolved beyond that point 3 years later, and the social and cultural aspects of forests for people. So UNFF9, I just want to tell you, will provide an outstanding opportunity to get input from your forum on issues such as the forest links to poverty eradication and human well-being, especially as we move between the MDG discussions this fall and then the Rio Plus 20 planning as we go ahead. And in that regard, of course, forest governance is a lively subject, including something we've recently called hybrid governance, which starts to recognize that some communities have special rights as developed in their own countries. We also talk about promoting rights and livelihoods, developing local leadership or supporting local leadership where it exists, and to look at legal reforms. And one of the most compelling issues I'm absolutely sure your forum has been dealing with in the forest area is the very sensitive subject of forest land conversion and the impact of forest land conversion on indigenous peoples, communities, on food, on energy, and water. So, from our standpoint, we don't own the subject, and we would welcome the forum's advice. We, as directed by the Secretary General of the United Nations, believe in operating as one United Nations, and we wish to share with you, provide information from us to you, but we also would like to hear from you what you think we should be doing differently. Through our major groups or multi-stakeholder dialogue, we would like to further engage Indigenous peoples in this upcoming session. We want to ensure that intellectual property issues are taken on board in, for example, any future RED implementation. And then finally, a little highlight for today, 2011 is the International Year of the Forests. And UNFF, my body, is the focal point for coordinating with the United Nations on International Year of the Forest. We are going to be promoting and showcasing what you're doing, what your countries are doing, what your communities are doing. And we have decided to focus on people at the local level, at the national level, and their experiences and how they live compatibly with forests and how some of the decisions being made now create obstacles and problems for Indigenous communities, for Indigenous peoples, and others. We want to raise the profile of forest issues in 2011. We want to recognize the multiple values and benefits, the cultural, spiritual, and economic. And we want you to be a part of that celebration. And so thank you very much. I appreciate being invited here to represent a large number of member states who work on this issue. They're colleagues and friends of yours, I think, in most cases. And I hope that, Mr. Chairman, that the United Nations Forum on Forests can work with its sister organization, the Indigenous Peoples Forum, from now forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Está con nosotros la señora ministra María Teresa Mezquita Pessoa de la Fundación Nacional Brasileña sobre Cuestiones Indígenas, FUNAI. Invitamos a la señora ministra a hacer su presentación.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This is a very busy day. This is today it's the World Energy Day, a very important item in the UN agenda as well. And it's a pleasure to be here to be speaking on behalf of National Foundation on Indigenous Issues on this important topic of forests. It's impossible to imagine Indigenous peoples in Brazil without the rainforest, or the rainforest without Indigenous peoples. Indigenous territories represent 13% of Brazil's landmass, 110 million hectares, an area approximately the size of France and Portugal. More than 220 peoples inhabit these lands in harmony with their natural resources. The territories correspond to environmental conservation and sustainable forest management areas. Satellite images reveal this very clearly. Indeed, Indigenous territories represent an immense green tapestry of native forest conservation. Brazil possesses the world's largest continuous tropical rainforest. The Brazilian Amazon is home to 15 to 20% of the 1.7 million of all known living species. Archaeological and ethnographic evidence suggests that a portion of what is considered wild forest in the Amazon could in fact be the product of thousands of years of organized natural resources management and use by the human populations in the region. This would imply that, quite apart from representing a purely natural phenomenon, part of the Amazon species, genetic and ecosystem diversity constitutes the product of a cultural process as well. Forests need to be considered from the perspective of sustainable development. Equally important to factors related to environmental protection, such as reduced deforestation and expanded afforestation, are those associated to economic, such as value-adding and use of economic instruments, commercial, such as access to market, social and cultural, such as the protection of traditional knowledge. On the international front, the world's forests are covered under the non-legally binding instruments on all types of forests adopted by United Nations on Forest, by the United Nations Forum on Forests, on which we have just heard Ms. McAlpine talk about. Currently, there is a discussion within the UNFF on the mobilization of international financial and technological resources, as well as capacity building. And it is the hope of Brazil that the proposal submitted by developing countries to the Global Forest Fund, a component of the United Nations Forum on Forests, will be approved upon conclusion in 2013 of the discussions currently underway. The non-legally binding instrument on all types of forest further provides for the need to adopt measures aimed at supporting the protection and use of traditional knowledge and practices associated to sustainable forest management, with the approval and involvement of the respective proprietors of that knowledge and promoting the equitable sharing of the benefits derived from the utilization of traditional knowledge. Issues such as financing for sustainable forest management, biodiversity conservation, protection of water resources, promotion of sustainable development, and equitable sharing of benefits derived from the use of genetic resources and associated traditional knowledge all have a real and immediate impact on the peoples inhabiting indigenous territories. International measures to support sustainable forest management through actions undertaken on indigenous lands must necessarily comply with the applicable national indigenous legislations. Among the indigenous rights that must be observed is the obligation to recognize the authority of indigenous communities to decide on the use of traditional knowledge associated with genetic resources. Information on the properties of genetic resources in forests provides invaluable assistance to scientific research. As such, a selection of research materials based on traditional knowledge of local flora and wildlife assumes substantial economic value. International instruments should protect traditional knowledge and assure sharing of the benefits arising from the use of genetic resources and associated traditional knowledge with the respective communities. Convention 169 of ILO of 1989, the first and only legally binding instrument to address the rights of indigenous and tribal groups, stands as a highly significant instrument for the protection of traditional knowledge. Equally important is the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples of September 2007, which guarantees the free, prior, and informed consent of indigenous peoples prior to the adoption of by states of legislative or administrative measures that may affect them. That is contained in Article 19 of the Declaration and assures indigenous peoples the right to their traditional medicines and to maintain their health practices. That includes the conservation of their vital medicinal plants, animals, and minerals, and reinforces the protection and guarantee of the right of indigenous communities to maintain, control, protect, and develop their traditional knowledge. The instruments referenced above served to inform the protection of traditional indigenous knowledge. Yet, an international regime is still required to determine how the benefits derived from biodiversity use are to be shared. It is Brazil's view that the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity is the appropriate instrument through which to establish the regime on access and benefit sharing. In a manner consistent with the Convention on Biological Diversity, The principle enunciated in the declaration, in the Rio Declaration on the Environment and Development, recognizes the sovereignty of nations over their natural resources and aims at ensuring the conservation and sustainable use of biodiversity and equitable sharing of the benefits arising from the use of genetic resources and traditional knowledge. The convention provisions recognize the intricate and historic dependence of numerous local communities and indigenous populations with traditional lifestyles on biological resources, and the need to ensure equitable sharing of the benefits stemming from the use of traditional knowledge. Brazil is committed to the effort to conclude the negotiations on the Protocol on Access and Benefit Sharing and hopes that it will be adopted at the Conference of the Parties in Nagoya, Japan in October 2010, in this year, that is the year of biodiversity. The treaty will constitute a valuable instrument to ensure the rights of indigenous peoples, foster conservation and sustainable resource utilization, including on indigenous lands, combat poverty, and guarantee the attainment of the goals delineated in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. In the domestic front, Brazil has sought to institute territorial and environmental management mechanisms on indigenous lands in accordance with the needs of indigenous peoples, including the so-called Indigenous Portfolio, Carteira Indígena, an initiative aimed at food security. And this is part of a panoply of social policies that have been adopted to promote food security among indigenous peoples in Brazil. The pilot program, another of those policies, is the pilot program to conserve the Brazilian rainforest, Programa Piloto para a Proteção das Florestas Tropicais do Brasil, a key measure in the effort to demarcate indigenous territories. The National Policy for the Sustainable Development of Traditional Peoples and Communities, Política Nacional de Desenvolvimento Sustentável de Povos e Comunidades Tradicionais, the objective of which is to promote the sustainable development of traditional peoples and communities through an emphasis on recognizing, strengthening, and guaranteeing their territorial, social, environmental, economic, and cultural rights, while respecting and valuing their identity, their forms of organization and institutions. And this program also encompasses the traditional communities of quilombolas, which are the descendants of African slaves. There's also another policy adopted in Brazil, which is the Indigenous Peoples Demonstration Project, Projeto Demonstrativo dos Povos Indígenas, an effort implemented to fund indigenous proposals for sustainable economic activity, the valuing of cultural practices and traditions, and the protection of indigenous territories. And finally, the National Policy for Environmental Management of Indigenous Lands, geared to recognizing the importance of indigenous lands for biodiversity conservation and the need to implement measures to support indigenous peoples in the adoption of mechanisms for sustainable natural resources management and use and land use. In sum, in the context of the rights of indigenous peoples, it is Brazil's firm conviction that the protection of traditional knowledge bears equal importance to the host of other relevant issues for indigenous peoples, including the right to health and land. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Gracias a usted, señora ministra. Vamos a invitar ahora a presentar su participación a nuestra colega, señora Victoria Tauli Corpus. Señora Tauli Corpus,
Tiene la palabra.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. I would like to speak from the perspective of an indigenous person whose people depend on tropical rainforest, particularly in Asia, but also in other parts of the world. The history of how colonizers and states have tried to take control over forests of indigenous peoples is a very painful story and has left a tragic legacy for indigenous peoples who still continue to suffer from national laws which are still colonialist and state-centric. These are laws and policies like eminent domain, regalian doctrine in the Philippines, crown lands, among others, which give the state the right to decide how forests should be used and governed. Most countries have high levels of forest cover before colonization. I can speak in the Philippines, before the Spanish colonizers came, we are almost 100% forest cover, and then after the colonizers, the Spanish left after 350 years, and Americans left after 50 years, we are only left with 50% forest cover. And after all the post-colonial governments, we now only have 20 to 25% of forest cover. But that just goes to show that these colonialist laws and policies are really the main reasons why these forest covers have decreased significantly. In many countries, in my country in particular, the first institutions that colonial governments set up are colleges or universities of forestry. No, and these colleges have promoted the concept of so-called scientific forestry, which mainly looked at the forest as a source of income and a source of timber and other forest products that they can use to generate income for the governments and for the business interests who are interested in this. No, this concept of scientific forestry is very contradictory to the traditional worldviews, traditional knowledge of indigenous peoples over forests, and also the governance systems, the customary governance systems that indigenous peoples have used over their forests. And this concept of scientific forestry has been heavily promoted by intergovernmental institutions like the UN, FAO, for instance, UNEP, and even UNESCO, and the World Bank, the Asia Development Bank, as well as the Inter-American Development Bank. No, this is mainly to ensure that, you know, our forests are really part of the global market in terms of exporting logs, etc. In the 70s, the Tropical Forestry Action Plan was conceptualized and funded by these institutions and also bilateral institutions like those coming from the USA and even the Nordic countries like Finland. Finland, for instance, has given a lot of loans to many developing countries with tropical rainforests, and they funded the consultancy firm called Jaakko Pöyry, you know, to develop the forestry master plans of most of these countries. And these forestry master plans are really the plans which allowed for the exploitation and extraction of forest resources and which has caused a lot of violations of indigenous people's rights. This has also led actually to the use of forests in patronage politics in most countries, most developing countries. The usual practice is that politicians give logging licenses or plantation licenses to their cronies or families who are given the right to exploit these forests. No, and this is the thing that has happened in many countries. In fact, most struggles of indigenous peoples in many parts of the world have really started in their fight to protect their forests as well as their customary systems to govern forests. I started my indigenous activism in a campaign which we fought in the 70s against a logging concession given by President Marcos to his crony to log almost 300,000 hectares of pine and mossy forest, which covers in my own hometown in Bisao Mountain Province in the Philippines. We fought for many years against this concession, And some people even took up arms to fight against this concession. But in the end, we won. Dicini, the crony of Marcos, has to leave, and we kept our forests still intact. And in fact, these are the only one of the few remaining rainforests in the Philippines today. But that is because of the fight and the struggle that we had to do to be able to protect these forests. Now, I would like to show what are the problems that indigenous peoples face in the who live in the tropical rainforests. It is estimated that there are around 60 million indigenous peoples in tropical rainforests in the developing countries. No, also in Australia, I think they do have tropical rainforests. No, but in the data, it has shown that these people are the ones who live in the worst situations of poverty. They are the ones who suffer the worst forms of human rights violations. And the countries where they come from are recorded in the Transparency International data as the most corrupt. No? So there is a link between the control over the forest and the kind of corruption that's happening in most of our countries. No? And yet, in spite of this, we are the ones who were most successful in protecting our forests at the risk of life and limb, of course. And this is why the reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation of that is being promoted by the UNFCCC is now targeting our forests. No? The tropical forests are estimated to contain carbon, which is almost equivalent to the carbon that is now found in the atmosphere. No? And it was estimated by scientists that 17% to 20% of carbon dioxide emissions are coming from tropical rainforests, and therefore it is important to stop deforestation of this forest, because if that's not stopped, then the forest will not be able to sequester carbon, but also the amount of carbon in the forest and under the forest will be released into the atmosphere. And this is the reason why RED is a very important scheme for climate change mitigation. Now, the other problem that many indigenous peoples face is also the conservation initiatives. As we all know, many of the indigenous peoples' forests have been carved out to be national parks or wilderness reserves, and this have led to the displacement or eviction of indigenous peoples from their traditional territories. No, and one recent example, for instance, is the Mau forests, where the Ugyek peoples are going to be relocated. And in fact, the UNEP, which is an UN organization that signed the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous, that is supposed to implement the declaration, is involved in helping relocate these Ogyek peoples from the Mau forests. No, this is a story that can be heard in many parts of the world, no, whether in Africa, in Asia, or in Latin America. In fact, in India, they say that when a forest person kills a tiger, he will be arrested. No, but when he protects his forest, he is also arrested. No, so it's really a very sad situation the way conservation organizations have dealt with the forest, primarily because they believe that the forest can be conserved by kicking away the people from the forest. And yet indigenous peoples practice, and history will show that it's because the people, indigenous peoples, are in their forest that they manage to protect their forest as well as the biodiversity in these forests. No? And so I think the actions taken by conservation organizations are really actions that need to be addressed, and justice should be provided to the victims of conservation policies and programs that has led to the eviction of indigenous peoples from their forests. Now, the third problem is, of course, the continuing deforestation and logging, as well as plantation development in indigenous peoples' forests. This is an experience that we have faced in many parts of the world, especially in Asia, from where I come from. Oil palm plantations, biofuel plantations, which are being pushed in the name of climate change mitigation, are also causing the displacement of indigenous peoples from their forests. And this is leading to a lot of arrests and fights, both in the courts as well as outside of the courts. And this is a very sad situation, because under the name of climate change, indigenous peoples' rights are being violated to increase or expand the plantations that are supposed to be used for alternative sources of energy. No? So having said that, I would just like to end by saying that in the light of this kind of situation, the Permanent Forum has seriously taken these issues into consideration. And they have, in fact, that's the reason why we now have a half-day session on forest. And we believe that we should be able to use the International Year of Forest that was declared by the General Assembly in December 20 last year. 2011 is the International Year of Forest, and we should really take advantage of this to bring into the fore the issues of indigenous peoples related to forest, to address the issues of why deforestation continues in spite of the existence of the UN Declaration, and why free, prior, and informed consent is not being obtained when policies and programs related to forests are being developed and implemented. We also believe that that we will be able to have contributions from indigenous peoples to share about how they have consistently protected their forest through the use of their traditional forest management practices, as well as their practices in terms of governing the forest, the customary use of the forest. No? And also, we would like to see that the links between the traditional livelihoods of indigenous peoples related to forest, conservation, and conservation of biological diversity are very close. They are very interlinked, and of course, this has to be strengthened and made more visible in the international level as well as at the national level. So I would just like to end by saying that I think it is about time that the international community and states really recognize the rights of indigenous peoples to their forests and to their forest resources, that they should reform the policies and the colonialist policies and state-centric policies over and laws over forests, and that they should give the indigenous peoples the right to continue practicing their traditional knowledge and their traditional forest management practices, as well as their customary governance systems over the forest. We believe that it is only by doing these kinds of measures that indigenous peoples can continue to protect biodiversity, the cultural diversity that comes with it, as well as the climate change mitigation processes that indigenous peoples contribute to the world and, of course, to the future generations. Thank you very much.
Agradecemos a la señora ministra María Teresa Mezquita Pessoa de la Fundación Nacional Brasileña sobre Cuestiones Indígenas, a la señora Jan McAlpin, secretaria del Foro de las Naciones Unidas sobre los Bosques, y a nuestra colega señora Victoria Tauli Corpus. Ahora invitaremos a los siguientes oradores: señor Pavel Zulian Siga, miembro del Foro Permanente; señor Tom Goldot, del Programa Indígena sobre el Medio Ambiente; señor Yader Mendoza Levis, representante del Foro Indígena Latinoamericano sobre Cambio Climático. Ruego me acompañen al podio. Thank you. Invitamos al señor Pavel Zuliansiga, nuestro colega del Foro Permanente, a hacer su presentación. Señor Zuliansiga, tiene usted la palabra.
Спасибо, уважаемый председатель, дорогие друзья. Меня зовут Павел Сулинзига. Сам я из народа УДГ, который проживает на Дальнем Востоке Российской Федерации. Численность моего народа составляет чуть более 1600 человек. Это всего 4 населенных пункта. Сегодня коренные народы Российской Федерации, коренные народы Севера Сибири и Дальнего Востока России объединены в ассоциацию, которая объединяет 40 народов и имеет во всех северных и дальневосточных субъектах Российской Федерации свои представительства и подразделения. Высшим форумом нашей организации является съезд коренных народов, который проходит раз в 4 года. Темой сегодняшнего нашего обсуждения является проблема, которая вытекает из проблемы в целом развития человечества. Понятие развития достаточно обширно, однако для наших народов оно тесно переплетено с ведением традиционного природопользования и хозяйствования. Душа наших народов – это душа оленевода и охотника, рыбака и собирателя, человека, который живет в тайге, в тундре, среди нетронутой дикой природы, в суровых условиях. Традиционное природопользование для наших народов – это не просто способ существования, это образ жизни. Не так давно, например, всего каких-то 50 лет назад, мой народ насчитывал 8 этносов, проживающих в различных местах Сихотайлинского хребта. А сейчас у нас всего осталось 4 этноса. Наша жизнь неразрывно связана с тайгой и рекой. А у наших братьев и сестер, иманских, унгарийских, приморских, курумийских, УДГ, вырубили окружающую тайгу, из-за этого обмелели реки, и они вынуждены были покинуть свою родину. Не стало тайги, не стало и народа. Поэтому свое развитие наши народы, и вы все об этом хорошо знаете, неразрывно связывают с окружающей нас природой. Так случилось, что основные природные ресурсы оказались в местах проживания коренных народов Севера Сибири и Дальнего Востока России. Это означает, что в предстоящие десятилетия, даже столетия, экономика нашего государства, нашей страны будет развиваться за счет промышленного освоения недр на землях наших соплеменников. А значит, неминуемо столкновение разных цивилизаций, разных менталитетов, часто противоположных взглядов в отношении к окружающему миру. С одной стороны, традиционные нормы и правила, сформировавшиеся и установившиеся за тысячелетия со своими технологиями хозяйственной деятельности. С другой стороны, техногенное воздействие на среду обитания. И здесь невозможно решить проблему без права этих народов на участие в процессе принятия решений. Я хотел бы рассказать вам о случае, который имел место в Москве. Одна из очень влиятельных организаций, влиятельных в нашей стране, в которую входят многие известные российские политики и бизнесмены, рассматривала вопрос по программе освоения Сибири и Дальнего Востока и включила раздел «Помощь малым народностям». Скорее всего, это произошло по причине модности вопроса или из-за того, что многие из тех, кто добывает природные ресурсы, понимают, что их зарубежные партнеры, общественность будут задавать вопросы по коренным народам. Мне кажется, они думали, что коренные народы и специалисты которые готовили данный раздел, удовлетворяться своим положением просителей, принимающих подачки со стола богатых и влиятельных, и не ожидали, что темой подготовленного доклада станет вопрос о правах коренных народов. Для этих людей неподготовленный доклад стал большим сюрпризом, после которого было принято решение не разворачивать прения по этому вопросу, чтобы, по их мнению, не выпускать джина из бутылки. Они, к сожалению, не поняли, хотя на самом деле люди очень умные и образованные, что невозможно построить гражданское демократическое общество, как часто это ими самими провозглашается, без решения вопроса защиты прав коренных народов. Как я уже говорил, что я из народа Удыге, живущего в Уссурийской тайге. У нас есть места, где еще не ступала нога человека. Наша территория является богатейшей по своему биоразнообразию. Учеными признано, что наша территория является местом, где сошелся север и юг. На нашей территории есть эндемики, которые живут и произрастают только на юге, и есть эндемики, которые живут и произрастают только на севере. У нас же они собрались в одном месте. Я хочу показать вам очень коротко, как пример, жизнь моего народа. Приведу небольшую хронологию последних 20 лет борьбы за свои права. Как я уже говорил, у нас до недавнего времени было 8 этнических групп, в настоящее время осталось 4. Как я также говорил, что никто нас не уничтожал физически, не было никакого геноцида. Однако это произошло в силу того, что у нас, как я также говорил, уничтожили природу, поставили в условия, при которых стало невозможным заниматься традиционной деятельностью. Учитывая горький опыт наших братьев, оставшиеся 4 группы удыгейцев стали бороться за то, чтобы их территории были сохранены. В 1993 году, когда нашим землям стали угрожать лесопромышленники России и Южной Кореи, были приняты соответствующие распоряжения государственной власти о том, чтобы отдать наши территории под лесоразработки. Наша община совместно с общественностью выставила пикеты на лесных дорогах и у дома региональных властей во Владивостоке с целью недопущения рубок леса. Мне тогда удалось добиться приема у Бориса Николаевича Ельцина, председателя Верховного Совета РСФСР. Президента России. Наш представитель выезжал в Москву, и было принято решение о том, чтобы этот проект заморозить. На помощь пришли зеленые со всего мира, нас поддержали жители Приморского края, в пикетах с нами стояли уссурийские казаки. В конечном итоге нам удалось отстоять землю. В том же году самаргинская группа удыгейцев, узнав о планах вырубки лесов, заявила о защите своих прав. Власти также не пошли на конфликт. 1994 год. Военные строители планируют построить дорогу Хабаровск-Находка, которая являлась тогда стратегической и которая имела статус федеральной. Эта дорога проходила прямо посередине нашей территории и наносила вред нашим охотничьим угодьям. Нам удалось добиться того, чтобы военные строители и Министерство обороны село с нами за стол переговоров, и мы подписали с ними соглашение. Эта дорога обошла нашу территорию в стороне. 1995 год. Золотопромышленники решили добывать золото на одной из наших рек, и только наша твердая позиция и позиция губернатора Приморского края, тогдашнего губернатора Евгения Ноздратенко, сначала получить разрешение у аборигенов, прервала их планы. 1996 год. На земли самаргинских удыгейцев претендует российско-американская компания, обещая дать безвозмездную помощь в размере аж 60 тысяч долларов. Местные чиновники даже подделали подпись руководителя общины, но попались на этом, и процесс был приостановлен. 97-й год. Землю Хорски худыгейцы взяла в аренду на 50 лет одна лесопромышленная компания из Гонконга, выплатив аборигенам 100 тысяч долларов в виде 10 машин для нужд местной общины. 2001 год. Вся территория самаргинских удыгейцев отдана властями-лесопромышленникам без согласия удыгейцев. Однако после долгих переговоров мы подписали соглашение с этой компанией, которая полностью удовлетворяет нашим правам и интересам. 2002 год. Новая администрация Приморского края начала готовить свой план освоения природных ресурсов на нашей территории, в которой не было места правам удыгейцев. Нам удалось остановить эти планы. 2008 год. Большая часть территории иманских удыгейцев отдана под создание национального парка. Мы изначально поддерживали эту идею в связи с тем, чтобы обезопасить себя от притязаний лесопромышленников. Однако после того, как решение было принято, администрация парка ввела запрет на охоту для наших охотников, стала возбуждать уголовные дела против них. В 2009 году после долгих судебных процессов Верховный суд принял решение изъять данную территорию из состава парка и вернуть удыгейцам. 2009 год. Администрация Приморского края принимает решение о выставлении на продажу лесных ресурсов, а фактически саму территорию на 49 лет бекинских удыгейцев. Под давлением администрации президента Российской Федерации администрация Приморского края приняла решение признать победителем этого аукциона нашу общину. Почему я так подробно остановился на этой хронологии, из которой видно, что, к огромному сожалению, нашему народу приходится бороться за свои права, и очень мало времени остается на то, чтобы пытаться что-то созидать. Однако я должен сказать, что мы сейчас все-таки боремся и надеемся в связи с тем, что в последнем ежегодном послании президент нашей страны уделил в этом послании место коренным народам России, где он сказал, что наша задача, задача государства – сохранить эти народы, помочь им развиться, сохранить их культуру и традиционный образ жизни. И эти слова президента нашей страны вдохновляют нас на новую борьбу, на борьбу за наши права, за то, что все-таки справедливость будет Спасибо.
Muchas gracias, señor Julián Ziga. Ahora ofrecemos la palabra al señor Tom Goldtooth del programa indígena sobre el medio ambiente. Señor, tiene la palabra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Haumidakyapi Chande Weshteya Napke Chiyuzapido. My home is in northern central United States near the Canadian border. We live in the Great Lakes region. This is part of the Western Great Lakes Forest Ecoregion. In our region of Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, and the remote Upper Peninsula of Michigan harbor some of the most expansive forests remaining in the lower 48 parallel states of North America. My tribe in this area is the Eastern Band of Dakota of the Woodlands and Great Lakes region. We are called the Bede Wakantawans. I am also Dene or Navajo on my mother's side. We have a mix of white and red pines, jack pines, spruce fir, forest and a hardwood mix of aspen, birch, oak, and maple trees, and this dominates our ecosystem. Our home, our forest, is home to most of the wolves, black bears, bald eagles, as well as other sensitive wildlife species like the lynx, the cougar, the loon, the osprey, and many different fish species. The most dominant feature of my homeland is the water. We are in the Great Lakes region with hundreds of miles of shoreline on Lake Superior, tens of thousands of lakes, ponds, and wetlands, and thousands of miles of rivers and streams. In the United States, the government, U.S. government agency, the Forest Service, has run out of areas to log in other regions. So the rate of clear cutting our timber has increased in the national forests of the Great Lakes. The forests in our regions have long been grossly mismanaged and continue to suffer major ecological damage from logging, road building, and intensified motorized recreation. A significant threat on both federal, governmental, state, and even our indigenous tribal lands is widespread clear-cutting. The situation will certainly deteriorate in the coming years. The paradigm of the United States policy within our indigenous tribes has been an approach to look at our forests within our indigenous territories from an economic framework. Logging the trees within our indigenous territories has been a clear-cut policy that has resulted in completely altering our landscape, including a dependency of viewing our trees as a form of income. Since the logging industry has come into our territories, we have been forced from a subsistence consciousness to a market consciousness. Where I am from, our indigenous peoples are from the forest. Our consciousness is the totality of our relationship to our environment, the land, the water, the air, and all living things in our ecosystem. In my homeland, our consciousness is based upon our culture and spiritual relationship with the trees and all life. Our traditional culture is based upon a subsistence relationship to our trees. This forest ecosystem is where we obtain our foods, our medicines, our cosmovision, and certain teachings of how we are to live well. It's our global well-being. Since the logging industry came into our homelands, clear-cutting as a so-called tree harvesting model has been implemented. From a subsistence consciousness to a market consciousness has been forced upon our people. Trees are no longer looked at as a framework of culture and spirituality, but a source of money, a benefit framework as part of a colonial market system. There are indigenous families in our region that resist these colonial practices that have been imposed upon our people. My family is part of those families. But even within our leadership, acculturation and assimilation, a lot of the effects of what you heard yesterday in the presentations around historical trauma. These factors are big factors that take root in the way our leadership makes decisions. Within our indigenous brothers and sisters north of us, within Canada's boreal forest, is another very precious place on Mother Earth. Extending from Alaska across Canada, the boreal forest is the largest intact original forest in the world, larger than the Brazilian rainforest. The boreal forest is essential for preserving biodiversity, filtering our air and water, and providing a shield against climate change. The area is particularly important for our woodland caribou, our wolves, and hundreds of Canadian species that are on the verge of extinction in much of Canada. But the boreal forest is threatened. To date, only 12% is protected. Over 30% of the boreal forest is already being designated for logging, mining, and energy extraction, such as the tar sands oil development that some of you have heard about. Canada and U.S. energy policies under free trade agreements and energy security compacts has resulted in the devastation of millions of hectares of boreal forests in Canada. Millions of acres of boreal forests are clear-cut each year. The U.S. consumes more than half of all the trees logged in the boreal regions of Canada. Many of these trees is processed into catalogs and junk mail. As the forest disappears into this disposable products, the habitat for species is disappearing as well. So this provides a framework from my perspective, from my reality, when I talk about forests and the struggles we face in the north to protect our tree ecosystems. In recent years, we have been challenged with domestic proposals, national level initiatives to use our forests in North America within a carbon offset system. This has created much dialogue within our indigenous communities, which is just starting to take place. What has emerged in the discussion of using trees, the forest, as carbon stocks and putting a monetary pricing to using trees in these carbon markets has created deep divisions within our families and our communities of the North. For generations, our indigenous peoples of our forested regions have always regarded forests not simply resources to be exploited, but as a source of life and an integral part of our lifestyles. Our forests form the basis of our cultural and spiritual values and cannot be expressed in monetary values. In consultation with my elders and our ceremonial leaders, they have instructed me to convey to the world that when life, the trees, plants, and our traditional knowledge becomes part of a commodification system, that this is a prophecy of bad things to come to our indigenous peoples. Using our forests in the carbon market, whether it's in the global south with our brothers and sisters or in the north, raises serious concerns about the privatization of not only trees, but of the air, of carbon in the atmosphere, in our oceans. So that's why I'm taking advantage of this opportunity to inform people, the delegates here, that the carbon offset regime being negotiated by the World Bank and the UN RED program and many financial institutions have been fast-tracking a regime to use our forests as in the carbon market. And this is RED, RED Plus, and even RED Plus Plus. So furthermore, there's a lot of questions about using the carbon market, using through carbon trading and carbon offset systems. Many of our communities, whether it's in the north or in the south, have many questions that have not been answered. The risks are tremendous for us in these protection regimes of our forest areas. So there is no consensus of indigenous peoples on whether to support and participate in the carbon market as a tool for climate mitigation. The debates are just now taking place, and in many cases without adequate information on the complex matters of how the market would be solving climate change and how market regimes such as RED could potentially be used as a tool to protect indigenous peoples' rights to the forests. I just returned from the World Peoples Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth that was held last week in Cochabamba, Bolivia. There were 17 working groups developed, including one working group on indigenous peoples' issues. The working group I participated in was the Working Group 14 on forests. 70% of the participants of this forest working group were indigenous peoples, with the remainder being the fisher people, the campesinos, the farmers, and other forest-dependent community people. Interventions by NGOs within this forest working group were not supported because this was a people's movement. So it was the people who spoke up in these working groups. The process established was that these working groups brought these conclusions which developed the People's Accord. So the People's Accord that was developed in Cochabamba, in Bolivia, was strong in the consensus, and it was a difficult process that the indigenous peoples and the campesinos and the fisher people along the rivers of the forested regions of the south came to a conclusion condemning RED and using forests in these forest offset schemes. and I think that this is very important to recognize the accords that were adopted there, because it provides us direction of decisions that we must recognize, as well as the emerging resistance of indigenous peoples, like in Costa Rica, who are resisting RED. So there still exists many risks and lack of guarantees that protect the rights of indigenous peoples in forested areas. You know, history has seen attempts to commodify land, food, labor, forests, water, our genes, and our ideas. Carbon trading follows in the footsteps of this history and turns the Earth's carbon cycling capacity into property to be bought or sold in a global market. Through this process of creating a new commodity, carbon, the sacredness of Mother Earth's ability and capacity to support a climate conducive to life and human society is now passing into the same corporate hands that are destroying the climate. So in conclusion, there are many policy-oriented, practical, and financial measures that could be taken to stem the tide of unsustainable deforestation and forest degradation, but only if the political will to do so exists. The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change negotiation, which I have participated in along with our delegation in the North and South, is a last chance to take action to stop the worst excesses of climate change. The conservation of our forests depends on real solutions, real answers. The RED proposals currently on the table are designed to generate profits for polluters of the North, not to stop climate change. It's not a solution to mitigation. They must be replaced with new and real decisions to meet existing commitments to stop deforestation once and for all. And as our brother, Presidente Evo Morales, said in Cochabamba, we have to decolonize the atmosphere. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias, señor, por el testimonio de la importancia acerca de los bosques y también su reporte sobre la cumbre de Cochabamba. Yo quería decir algo también relacionado, que es más testimonial en mi caso. Yo provengo de un país de alturas. Mi territorio está sobre los 3,800 y 4,000 metros sobre el nivel del mar. Hasta que tuve 8 o 9 años, jamás en mi vida había visto un árbol. Tuve que ir a una ciudad para ir a un árbol importado. Y eso tiene que ver con las devastaciones causadas por el colonialismo, y creo que en esta sesión hemos hablado de forma bastante sobre los efectos que ha tenido el colonialismo sobre nuestros territorios y sobre nuestras vidas. Ya de adulto pude ver que mi territorio, en un tiempo antes de la llegada de los españoles y antes que se empiece con la extracción de minerales en mi territorio, estaba cubierto de árboles, había bosques nativos. Hay dos plantas, dos árboles en mi región. Uno se llama queñoa y el otro colle, que son dos árboles que, en el caso de la queñoa, es, dice, sagrada para los incas. Y estos árboles cubrían la mayor parte de la extensión de lo que ahora se conoce como el altiplano, pero de toda la extensión de los Andes. Alguna vez pude observar todavía bosques nativos en el Ecuador o en parte de la cordillera de mi país. La tala de árboles fue muy temprano en mi país, al descubrirse las minas de Potosí allá por los años 1540 hasta el 70, acabaron muy rápidamente con los bosques tan frágiles de altura. Y hoy nuestros territorios están amenazados por la desertificación. Los rigores del calentamiento global son mayores porque son escasas las lluvias y cuando vienen las lluvias arrasan también con todo. Entonces, siempre en esta perspectiva de pensar unas vías de desarrollo con identidad, creo que es importante en regiones como el mío pensar en restaurar cosas que no son, para nosotros son absolutamente desconocidos. Hay muchos niños, hay mucha gente que no va a ver en su vida un bosque. Y podríamos nosotros pensar en volver a tener bosques, porque mi país fue boscoso. Estoy hablando de la parte del altiplano. Nos quedan aún bosques en la Amazonía, en muchas partes de mi país. Y también pensar de forma decidida la necesidad de preservar esa gran reserva que tenemos para la humanidad, como es la Amazonía. Ahora voy a pasar a la lista de oradores. Tenemos en nuestra lista a la señora Gabriela Garduño, de la Misión Permanente de México. Señora Garduño, tiene usted la palabra.
Señor presidente, en las zonas forestales de México viven entre 13 y 15 millones de personas. De estas, 5 millones pertenecen a 43 pueblos indígenas, de los cuales, desafortunadamente, la mitad enfrentan condiciones de pobreza y para cubrir sus necesidades se ven obligados a recurrir a los recursos de sus bosques y selvas, según estudios de la Comisión Nacional Forestal, CONEFOR. Esta situación, junto con otros factores, propicia procesos de degradación del recurso forestal, pérdida de capital natural, subutilización de recursos maderables y no maderables. De la superficie con cubierta vegetal total del país, se estima que 75% pertenece a ejidos y comunidades, por lo cual el uso de estrategias e instrumentos de política para el desarrollo del sector forestal requieren de la participación directa de sus dueños y poseedores. Los objetivos de este plan son promover el acceso de los productores forestales indígenas a los beneficios de los programas de servicios ambientales, fortalecer la organización indígena a fin de incrementar sus capacidades de gestión y toma de decisiones, así como el desarrollo de esquemas locales de pago por servicios ambientales, fortalecer las capacidades de los productores forestales indígenas para mejorar el manejo de sus terrenos forestales mediante apoyos culturalmente pertinentes que les permitan mantener o incrementar la provisión de servicios ambientales cuando se encuentran adheridos a esquemas de pagos por estos. Conforme vaya avanzando la ejecución de este plan y sus acciones sean evaluadas, estaremos informando al Foro Permanente respecto a su impacto. Al interior de la Convención Marco de las Naciones Unidas sobre el Cambio Climático, actualmente se analiza el diseño e implementación de actividades de mitigación para enfrentarlo, en particular a través de la conservación y manejo de los recursos forestales. La participación de los representantes de los pueblos indígenas dentro de tales debates es fundamental para llevar a buen término toda recomendación y estrategia de ahí surgida. En el marco de la citada convención, México ha participado en el diseño e implementación de un mecanismo denominado reducción de emisiones derivadas de la deforestación y degradación forestal, donde se ha identificado el rol preponderante que habrán de tener los dueños y pobladores de las áreas forestales, destacando, por supuesto, a los pueblos y comunidades indígenas. Se prevé que a través de este mecanismo se canalicen recursos financieros para compensarlos por la conservación y manejo sustentable de sus bosques y selvas, a partir de las contribuciones que habrán de realizar los países desarrollados. Para la implementación de este mecanismo por cada país, un componente muy importante estará dirigido a construir capacidades técnicas y fortalecer la gobernanza local de las comunidades que habitan en las áreas forestales, para que puedan recibir plenamente sus beneficios y contribuir de manera efectiva a mitigar los efectos del cambio climático. Finalmente, entre las acciones que México ya desarrolla para combatir el cambio climático, en 2009 se asignó poco más de 1,000 millones de pesos para el pago de servicios ambientales, lo que permitió incorporar cerca de 488 mil hectáreas a la superficie acumulada neta de 1.9 millones de hectáreas de bosques y selvas atendidas. México está profundamente comprometido con las acciones de combate a los efectos del cambio climático. En este sentido, nuestro presidente, Felipe Calderón Hinojosa, ha dirigido a nivel internacional la promoción y protección de dicho tema. México albergará la 16ª Conferencia de las Partes de la Convención Marco de las Naciones Unidas sobre el Cambio Climático, en los meses de noviembre y diciembre de este año en Cancún, Quintana Roo, en cuyo marco mi país tendrá como objetivo alcanzar acuerdos con todos los actores involucrados bajo un consenso que demuestre que el sistema multilateral sigue teniendo vigencia para resolver los problemas que nos afectan a todos los países, pero también a todos los pueblos. Y quizá precisamente porque México es un país megadiverso, no solo en riqueza natural, sino de la derivada de su condición de país pluricultural, sustentada en sus pueblos indígenas, compartimos el respeto y cuidado de la naturaleza y de sus recursos. México fue el primer país en desarrollo que presentó su cuarta comunicación nacional a la Organización de Naciones Unidas, donde se indica con precisión cuánto estamos emitiendo de carbono, dónde podemos reducir nuestras emisiones y qué necesitamos para hacerlo. En el mismo marco del Acuerdo de Copenhague, México presentó sus compromisos unilaterales de reducir hasta un 30% sus emisiones de carbono para el 2020. Y México ha propuesto también la creación del Fondo Mundial para el Cambio Climático, el Fondo Verde, instrumento financiero que busca que las naciones cuenten con recursos adicionales para proyectos de mitigación y adaptación. El gobierno de México ha sido perceptivo de la sabiduría de sus pueblos indígenas en la conservación de la naturaleza. Ojalá este sea un ejercicio que nos contagie a todos, a los gobiernos de los países y a sus pueblos indígenas, para que juntos y en colaboración sumemos a un mejor futuro para nuestra madre tierra. Muchas gracias.
Gracias a usted. El próximo orador de nuestra lista es el señor John Coloni Longo, consejero del Ministerio de Asuntos para jóvenes.
Merci, monsieur le président.
Señor Coloni, tiene usted la palabra.
Merci, monsieur le président, de nous avoir accordé la parole. Mesdames et messieurs, en République démocratique du Congo, nous n'avons pas comme problème majeur la discrimination négative entre les populations, y compris les populations autochtones. De tous les temps, nos populations cohabitent harmonieusement, de telle sorte que les confrontations armées que nous avons connues ces derniers temps sont plus politiques que des problèmes des populations. L'exemple le plus probant que nous pouvons citer est qu'une année après l'indépendance, lorsque mourait le premier ministre, c'est un toi pygmé qui est devenu premier ministre, M. Ileo Songoamba. En outre, en 1987, M. Tabou, un toi, a été brillamment élu député national à la circonscription de Mambasa. Il ne me revient pas, bien sûr, ici, de déclarer que les peuples autochtones de la République démocratique du Congo sont aux anges. Ils connaissent de nombreux problèmes liés, d'une part, aux aspects de développement comme l'ensemble de nos populations, et d'autre part, aux stratégies malencontreuses adoptées pour le mieux-être des peuples autochtones, allant jusqu'à leur déplacement vers les villes. En effet, les peuples autochtones sont essentiellement liés à leur milieu naturel. Ainsi, la destruction continue de l'environnement, la déforestation sauvage par les coupes de bois, sans la moindre contrepartie pour les peuples autochtones, sont certainement les plus grands maux qui leur sont faits. En outre, il faut relever le fait que la loi foncière confie les sols et les sous-sols à l'État et par conséquent ne garantit pas les droits des peuples autochtones à disposer de leurs terres. À ce jour, dans le cadre de la célébration du cinquantenaire de notre accession à la souveraineté nationale et internationale, le ministère de la Jeunesse et des Sports a amorcé une réflexion pour le mieux-être de nos populations, notamment des populations autochtones. Une première préoccupation déjà relevée concerne l'organisation d'un corps de volontaires des jeunes qui se mettra à la disposition des populations défavorisées, dont les populations autochtones, en raison de leur vulnérabilité. Nous nous réjouissons de participer à ces forums car ils nous offrent l'opportunité de nous enrichir des expériences des uns et des autres. Nous serions donc aigrés à quiconque irait une expérience réussie dans le domaine de l'organisation du volontariat des jeunes et de l'encadrement des peuples autochtones de nous en faire part. C'est dans ce cadre que nous recommandons la tenue d'un forum des échanges réussis. Merci, Monsieur le Président, pour nous avoir accordé votre attention.
Gracias, señor. Daremos la palabra a nuestra colega Elisa Kanki, quien hará comentarios. Señora Kanki tiene la palabra.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente. Yo en esta tarde me quiero referir y rescatar una frase hecha por la representante de Brasil, cuando señaló que los pueblos indígenas no pueden ser nada sin los bosques, ni los bosques nada sin los pueblos indígenas. Escuchar ello ante Naciones Unidas y últimamente también dentro de los estados no compensan las grandes áreas forestales que a partir de 1972 se nos han ido quitando paulatinamente a los pueblos indígenas a nivel de todo el mundo. Esa es la experiencia de los pueblos indígenas que viven en los bosques, con los gobiernos. Primero, la política conservacionista, que en nombre de las áreas protegidas, grandes y un número grande de pueblos indígenas han sido desplazados y hoy se llama y viven ahora en áreas cercanas a las áreas protegidas. Ya no están en sus territorios. Esas áreas protegidas hoy por los estados, en su mayoría eran lugares sagrados, como un banco de ahorro para los pueblos indígenas, donde podían acudir en tiempos malos, tiempos en que el clima era duro. Hoy no tienen dónde recurrir. Luego vino la política forestal. esta política con el mensaje de que los pueblos indígenas no aprovechaban los recursos, el Estado estaba en el derecho de hacer concesiones forestales para explotar esas áreas. Los recursos jamás llegaron a los pueblos indígenas. Los pueblos indígenas lo único que vieron fueron árboles en los ríos, árboles, troncos de árboles pasando por las carreteras que han abierto dentro de los bosques. Esa es la experiencia de los pueblos indígenas que viven en los bosques con las políticas. Y es por eso la respuesta de los pueblos indígenas ahora en contra de Red. ¿Quién nos garantiza que nos va a beneficiar? Y es por eso el acuerdo en Cochabamba. Porque en este momento la única estrategia posible que tenemos como pueblos indígenas para que los estados nos escuchen es un no. No tenemos otra estrategia. Y eso no es desconocer acciones que algunos gobiernos de muy buena fe, en alianza y reconociendo este rol histórico de los pueblos indígenas de protección, reconociendo su conocimiento de los bosques, están empezando a trabajar y están viendo y volviendo su mirada a los pueblos indígenas para hacerles sus aliados. No se desconoce eso, pero tampoco líderes indígenas, expertos independientes, están en el derecho de decir que no vale el acuerdo de Cochabamba. Los pueblos indígenas tienen derecho. Y como decía el hermano, porque está en un inicio proceso de negociación, va a haber este tipo de diferencias. Pero diferencias que no son motivo nuestro, son esta experiencia histórica de mala fe de muchos estados. La implementación de este tipo de políticas en los cuales siempre los pueblos indígenas hemos perdido. No queremos que se repita la historia. Queremos ser parte del proceso. Tenemos derecho y queremos que se nos reconozca el rol histórico de los pueblos indígenas de conservar los bosques. Y gracias a nosotros, gracias a los pueblos indígenas, están los bosques en este momento en el mundo. Y eso debe ser reconocido por los programas, por los fondos y por cualquier acción que el Estado, Naciones Unidas u otra instancia empiece a desarrollar. Gracias.
Nuestro próximo orador en la lista es el señor embajador Pablo Solón, representante permanente ante las Naciones Unidas del Estado Plurinacional de Bolivia. Señor embajador, tiene usted la palabra.
Muy buenas tardes, señor presidente. Voy a dar lectura a la posición sobre bosques y cambio climático aprobada por la Conferencia Mundial de los Pueblos sobre el Cambio Climático y los Derechos de la Madre Tierra, que se realizó entre el 19 y el 22 de abril en la ciudad de Cochabamba. Quiero mencionar que de esta conferencia participaron 35.000 representantes de 140 países. Primero, es inaceptable incluir las plantaciones en la definición de bosques que se viene utilizando en las negociaciones de cambio climático. Los monocultivos no son bosques. Exigimos una definición que reconozca que los bosques nativos y la selva, montes, bosques templados, de clima árido, manglares, bosques nativos andinos, bosques de la Patagonia, páramos, bofedales, juncales, bejucales y otros, tienen origen en la madre tierra y son la casa grande donde coexisten plantas, animales, agua, suelo, aire, seres humanos y espirituales. Segundo, los bosques nativos y selvas contribuyen a la vida, a la protección de los ecosistemas frágiles, al ciclo del agua y regulan las cuencas hidrográficas, protegen de las inundaciones, erosiones, desastres naturales, son fundamentales para la soberanía alimentaria, proporcionan medicinas naturales y tradicionales, albergan la biodiversidad descubierta y por descubrir. Por lo tanto, no aceptamos la reducción de los bosques nativos y selvas a una simple cantidad mesurable de carbono ni a proveedores de servicios. Tercero, la Declaración de la ONU sobre los derechos de los pueblos indígenas debe ser plenamente reconocida, implementada e integrada en la discusión de cambio climático, considerando especialmente que la mayoría de los bosques y selvas están en los territorios de pueblos y naciones indígenas. Cuarto, el reconocimiento de los derechos colectivos de las tierras y territorios indígenas es la mejor estrategia para evitar la deforestación, degradación y proteger los bosques nativos y la selva. Cinco, las causas de la deforestación y degradación son el resultado de un proceso histórico de explotación colonial del sistema capitalista y de sobreconsumo de los países desarrollados. Los programas multilaterales del Banco Mundial, Banco Internacional de Desarrollo, Fondo Monetario Internacional y otras agencias e instituciones multilaterales financieras son también responsables por la deforestación, por desarrollar sin límites las cadenas productivas, el avance de la frontera agrícola industrial y ganadera intensiva y patrones de degradación consumista y capitalista del modelo extractivista a través de la minería, la industria maderera, las camaroneras, los agronegocios y agrocombustibles, las represas e hidroeléctricas, la exploración y explotación de hidrocarburos, construcción de infraestructura, etc. Asimismo, son responsables las transnacionales de farmacéuticos y biogenéticos. Sexto, condenamos los mecanismos de mercado neoliberal como el mecanismo de red, reducción de emisiones por la deforestación y degradación de bosques, y sus versiones más y más más, que está violando la soberanía de nuestros pueblos y su derecho al consentimiento libre, previo e informado, así como a la soberanía de los estados nacionales, porque este mecanismo está violando los derechos, usos y costumbres de los pueblos y los derechos de la naturaleza. Séptimo, demandamos que los países contaminadores reconozcan su deuda histórica, ecológica y climática y, en consecuencia, transfieran de manera directa los recursos económicos y tecnológicos para pagar la restauración y mantenimiento de los bosques y selvas en favor de los pueblos, naciones y estructuras orgánicas ancestrales indígenas, originarias y campesinas. Esto deberá ser una compensación directa y adicional, fuera del mercado de carbono, y jamás debe servir para los llamados offsets, a través de los cuales los países desarrollados incumplen sus compromisos de reducción de sus gases de efecto invernadero. Por lo tanto, demandamos a los países, como corresponda, detener las iniciativas locales en bosques y selvas basados en mecanismos de mercado y que proponen resultados inexistentes y condicionados. Octavo, las plantaciones de árbol bajo el mecanismo de desarrollo limpio en el marco del Protocolo de Kioto son una falsa solución que amenaza los bosques y selvas nativas y viola los derechos de los pueblos. Las plantaciones forestales para créditos de carbono, así como para agrocombustibles, son una falsa solución al cambio climático. Noveno, las soluciones deben ser holísticas, respetuosas de la madre tierra y de los derechos de la humanidad. Las propuestas son: los conocimientos ancestrales y las prácticas comunitarias y locales de los pueblos históricamente han contribuido al equilibrio de estos ecosistemas y, por lo tanto, deben ser incluidos como soluciones para enfrentar la deforestación, degradación y fragmentación de los bosques y selvas al cambio climático. Proponemos la creación de un grupo de expertos sobre cambio climático con la participación y representación plena y efectiva de los pueblos que viven en los bosques nativos y selvas, como un órgano asesor de la Convención Marco sobre Cambio Climático para promover la conservación de los bosques en forma ancestral, impulsando y fortaleciendo sus capacidades, revalorizando este conocimiento, patrimonio de la humanidad y valorando así su identidad cultural. La participación de las mujeres deberá ser al menos del 50% en este grupo de expertos. Impulsamos la gestión y administración directa a cargo de los pueblos. Los países deben eliminar las concesiones forestales que históricamente tienen usos mercantiles e intensivos y aumentan su área sin respeto por la armonía con la madre tierra. La educación formal convencional en base a la máxima productividad no armoniza con el conocimiento ancestral de manejo integral de bosques y selva para su conservación. En consecuencia, se demanda a los gobiernos complementar los currículos educativos con conocimientos ancestrales. Demandamos a los gobiernos un programa mundial de restauración ecológica de bosques y selvas dirigido por los pueblos. Proponemos implementar y consolidar bancos de semillas forestales, frutales y de flora autóctonas de acuerdo a los sitios. Planteamos la modificación de leyes para el establecimiento de drásticos castigos por la quema y tala de bosques nativos y selvas. Proponemos incentivar la unificación de la agricultura y bosques nativos y selvas como componentes de un todo. Muchísimas gracias y esta es la posición que asume el Estado Plurinacional de Bolivia. Muchas gracias.
Gracias, señor embajador. Nuestro próximo orador en la lista es el señor Vittorio Prodi del Parlamento Europeo. Señor Prodi, tiene la palabra.
Thank you very much, Chairman. we have discussed already on this subject at the European Parliament. We have not really reached any decision, and so I can give you some perception about the feeling in the Parliament, and not any specific decision. We start from the fact that deforestation is responsible for 20% of the emission of greenhouse gases, and also the other fact that this could be the quickest action we could take in order to decrease emission of greenhouse gases. So, in general, there is red and red plus is seen as favor, but of course with a different feeling from what it has been presented up to now, and that is that in a framework in which already deforestation is taking place, then we could think of a mechanism of compensation to countries that have rainforests or old forests that could preserve their forest in intact manner, very rigorously. And of course, that could be the compensation could be somehow evaluated in terms of the trading of carbon, but it is not. a mechanism of carbon trading. It is a compensation for keeping intact is an overall service to the atmosphere and to the environment in general. And that's why we already are thinking of having tools to evaluate the situation. And specifically, there is a constellation of satellites that can measure several parameters of relating to global warming, and that is, of course, the temperatures, the humidity, vegetation, and, of course, these satellites could be also available to measure exactly could be the forest that is kept intact. Of course, these satellites would always need an in-situ observation. And then, of course, here is the role of indigenous population that could be the guarantor of from the ground of the condition of conservation. So, of course, it is also seen in prospects, because we have simply to decrease to 1/5 our emission before 2050. So this is an emergency, and then we have to get that result, otherwise it will be a catastrophe. So this has to be looked at in this perspective. And of course, and this is my personal feeling, I think that the atmosphere cannot be on sale. But I think that if there is any sustainable level of emissions that could be probably 1/5 of the present emission, that is 5 tons per person per year, and we should come by 2050 to 1 ton per person per year. My personal opinion is that we have to recognize the right of every person to the use of the atmosphere, and that is one allowance per person per year free, in a context in which every other emission should be paid by auctioning. So, and that, of course, hopefully, to get to a sustainable situation in 40 years from now. So it has to be seen in the context of an emergency, because we are now in the situation we can still avoid a catastrophe, and we have to use every means. And of course, this is the red. If it can be seen in this perspective, and with the strong role of indigenous people, that could be the custodians of the forest on behalf of the entire world. Thank you.
Gracias, señor. Proseguimos con nuestra lista de oradores. La señora Gloria Ramos, presidente de la Comisión Especial Multipartidaria para Pueblos Indígenas del Perú, tiene la palabra. Señora Ramos.
Por aquí. Presente.
Aquí.
Tiene la palabra.
Muchas gracias. El Foro Permanente sobre Cuestiones Indígenas de las Naciones Unidas, como un órgano asesor del Consejo Económico y Social de la ONU, constituye un espacio para analizar, incidir y sensibilizar en la comprensión y cumplimiento de los derechos individuales y colectivos de los pueblos indígenas del mundo. Precisamente, en ese sentido, como legisladora de un país constitucional y objetivamente declarado pluricultural y multiétnico, donde coexisten más de 75 pueblos indígenas, y se hablan 67 lenguas con una población de más de 28 millones de habitantes, de los cuales casi 4 millones son pobladores indígenas de los Andes y cerca de 400.000 son indígenas amazónicos, me corresponde informar el análisis del contexto nacional peruano. Hace un año atrás, el Perú vivió uno de sus mayores conflictos sociales entre los pueblos indígenas de la selva y el Estado peruano. Se desencadenó en los lamentables sucesos de Bagua, donde perdieron la vida muchos peruanos. Estos hechos han permitido que las organizaciones representativas de los pueblos indígenas en el Perú puedan sentarse frente a las autoridades del Estado y de forma conjunta elaborar propuestas de inclusión, respeto y desarrollo. No obstante de haberse desarrollado un significativo trabajo técnico y de consenso para las propuestas presentadas en el 2010, no existe una verdadera voluntad política de las autoridades del gobierno peruano para implementarlas. También en el Parlamento peruano existe un limitado interés de desarrollar leyes favorables para los pueblos indígenas peruanos. Actualmente los pueblos indígenas tienen muchos problemas, entre los que quisiera destacar puntualmente es el tema de la propiedad y el territorio. Uno de los mayores problemas para los pueblos indígenas de la Amazonía es que en el Perú la titulación de propiedad, entre comillas, de las comunidades, parte desde una lógica agraria, es decir, el sistema se construye tomando como base la actividad agropecuaria. Por tal motivo, se pone énfasis en el aseguramiento de la tierra como elemento fundamental de la actividad que serviría, también lo pongo entre comillas, de autosustento a los pueblos indígenas, por lo que la titulación únicamente comprende tierras con aptitud agraria, mientras que las tierras con aptitud forestal solamente se les cede en uso. El análisis efectuado por el Estado para titular una parte y ceder en uso en otra se origina de una premisa errada, que es considerar que las comunidades nativas basan su subsistencia y desarrollo en base a la actividad agrícola. Sin embargo, los pueblos indígenas amazónicos tienen una relación única con la foresta, con los productos del bosque y con el bosque mismo. Las poblaciones indígenas de la Amazonía tienen ese tipo de relación, viven del bosque, su vida espiritual y su vida material proceden del bosque y van hacia el bosque. Además, habiéndose reconocido a nivel internacional que los indígenas de la Amazonía son los primeros conservadores del bosque amazónico. En este sentido, este análisis sobre titularles la parte agropecuaria y cederles en uso la parte forestal no tiene ninguna explicación lógica. Desde 1991 se han promovido la ampliación de las actividades mineras. Hoy abarca 23 millones de hectáreas, comprometiendo las tierras de unas 3.200 comunidades campesinas andinas y nativas amazónicas. Desde el año 2004 se han incrementado los proyectos hidrocarburíferos, pasando del 13% a un 75% del área lotizada de la Amazonía en solo 5 años. Esta situación está generando conflictos socioambientales y muertes innecesarias como los trágicos sucesos de Bagua. Por otro lado, las supuestas consultas no son tales y en la práctica se han limitado a reuniones informativas y audiencias públicas unilaterales que solo buscan utilizar a los pobladores y se hacen después de las negociaciones del Estado con la empresa, siendo el caso que las observaciones de las comunidades no tienen carácter vinculante. Actualmente se viene trabajando en el Congreso de la República una ley marco de consulta previa a los pueblos indígenas. Empero, dentro del Congreso existen diversas concepciones y enfoques que buscan limitar el derecho a la consulta sin respetar lo que establece el Convenio 169. El Ministerio del Ambiente no tiene autoridad o poder de efectuar un cambio significativo en el sector de energía y minas. La aprobación de los estudios de impacto ambiental, la participación de la población, la consulta a los pueblos indígenas, la fiscalización sobre el cumplimiento de la normatividad ambiental y los instrumentos de gestión continúan como competencia del Ministerio de Energía y Minas, siendo que instrumentos como el proyecto de ley forestal no considera los derechos de los pueblos indígenas. Por tanto, recomendamos que este foro permanente sobre cuestiones indígenas de las Naciones Unidas exhorte al gobierno peruano para que respete los derechos económicos, sociales y culturales de los pueblos indígenas y además que implemente el derecho a la consulta previa, libre e informada en los diferentes niveles de gobierno. Muchas gracias.
Gracias, señora diputada. Nuestra próxima oradora de la lista es la señora Sirihanna Suba del Caucus del Asia. Señora Suba, tiene la palabra. ¿Está en sala la señora Suba? Tiene usted la palabra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We welcome the initiative of United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues for allotting a half a day session on indigenous peoples and forests. Sustaining forests are an integral part of our traditional knowledge, innovation, and practices, specifically on forest and resource management systems that are strictly regulated by our customary laws and worldviews. These forests and other natural resources are the very basis of our sustained traditional livelihood, social organizations, identities, and cultures. However, indigenous people continue to face worsening situation and problems related to exploitation and destruction of our forest and resources. Our social, economic, cultural, and spiritual relationship with the forest and other natural resources has not been recognized by the most governments. We continue to be displaced and criminalized for using our own lands and forests, which governments have declared as national protected areas, conservation areas, and so forth. Mr. Chairperson, in addition to this, forests are now seen as having an important role in mitigating and adapting to climate change. Thus, various efforts and initiatives have been undertaken to achieve this objective. This includes, for example, the reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation in developing countries, RED or RED Plus. This initiative is a grave concern for indigenous people as it might result in further violation of the rights of the indigenous people. We call on 1. UN RED, World Bank, FPCF, conservation organization, and concerned Asian governments to respect indigenous people's right to land, territories, and customary resource use of forest when implementing RED projects in indigenous people's territories. 2. UN Forum on Forest to implement proposals for actions adopted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Forest and Intergovernmental Forum on Forest, in particular those related to indigenous peoples. 3. Indigenous experts to conduct comprehensive studies on existing traditional governance on forest and organize seminar workshops on strengthening and promoting indigenous peoples and forest with due respect and recognition of customary rights of indigenous peoples to their forest and resources. 5. State recognize, respect, and support existing traditional land rights and customary governance systems used by indigenous peoples in sustainably managing, conserving, and using their forest. 6. Conservation organization, UN agencies, and governments to plan and implement programs with indigenous peoples aimed at strengthening and revitalizing indigenous knowledge and system of governance on forest and develop appropriate mechanisms to address the transfer of these practices and traditional knowledge to the younger generation. 7. We welcome the recent efforts of conservation organizations to recognize human rights and integrate the respect for indigenous people rights as enshrined in UNDRIP in their policies and operation processes. We call on other organizations and cooperation to follow this example as a part of implementation of UNDRIP. Finally, UN agencies to support and strengthen the role of indigenous women on forest conservation and management and ensure their rights and well-being, especially within their territories. We will submit the longer version of this statement on your desk. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Ahora daremos la palabra a nuestros colegas del foro permanente. Señora Tonia Gonella, tiene usted la palabra.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank the distinguished panelists for their excellent presentations today and all of the information that they've given us, and also from the delegates from the floor. Mr. Chairman, the recommendations that were shared with us from the European Parliament were very interesting indeed. Indigenous peoples have been invited to participate, it seems to me, in the same market-based economy that has created the crisis that we have today. Indigenous peoples have been bringing our message of the oncoming crisis for some years now to this forum, to the Working Group on Indigenous Populations, to many UN forums throughout the years. And I'm glad to see that finally this message is being taken seriously. I believe that the message that our brother Tom Goldtooth brought forward earlier, and the ambassador of Bolivia, was that there is a crisis and that some of the mechanisms that are being recommended to solve the crisis have been rejected by some of our indigenous peoples. For instance, the People's Accord that was read to us a few minutes ago has said that RED Plus and RED Plus Plus is not something that is being deemed acceptable, that some of the ideas of carbon trading and using trees as carbon stocks and carbon offset systems are not necessarily going to be the solutions to the problem. And the question has been put forward, how will the market solve the crisis? This still isn't clear to me, and I don't think it's clear to many of us sitting in this room. It just doesn't seem to make sense that we are going to use the same model that created the problem to solve the problem. So if we could have more clarification on how some of these mechanisms are going to work in a positive manner, especially for indigenous peoples and our nations and communities, I think we could have a way to move forward, a way to work in partnership. But we just need more clarity on these mechanisms. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias a usted por sus observaciones y las preguntas. Estoy seguro que en el debate que tenemos hoy vamos a encontrar esas respuestas. Señor Clavero, usted tiene la palabra.
Gracias, señor presidente. Entre toda la información que hemos recibido hoy tarde y las reflexiones interesantísimas, quería comentar en particular la intervención de la señora Gloria Ramos por Perú, pero no exactamente por el gobierno de Perú, sino por el Congreso, como presidenta de la Comisión de Pueblos Andinos, amazónicos, agrodescendientes, etcétera, afro, perdón, del Congreso peruano. y la forma como nos ha explicado hasta qué punto y con qué contumacia el gobierno de Perú, también el Congreso en su totalidad o la justicia en Perú, se resista a cualquier reconocimiento efectivo de derecho a bosques, como de derecho a otros a recursos dentro de los bosques de los pueblos indígenas. ¿Qué argucias jurídicas se siguen utilizando en Perú para hacer imposible esos reconocimientos de derechos pese a la instancia y a la constancia con que las instituciones internacionales, en el caso de Perú, sobre todo desde posiciones muy firmes, la Organización Internacional del Trabajo está requiriendo a Perú que modifique sus argumentos, sus identificaciones, su modo de plantear las cuestiones jurídicas respecto a los pueblos indígenas, empezando porque Perú sigue resistiéndose a llamar a los pueblos indígenas pueblos indígenas y sigue manteniendo el lenguaje de comunidades nativas, comunidades campesinas, para impedir o dificultar que el derecho internacional de los derechos humanos tenga una recepción efectiva en beneficio de los pueblos indígenas, fundamentalmente los amazónicos, pero no solo. Y quería con esto también pasar una reflexión un poco más general a la del interés que en un foro como este la voz de los estados no se reduzca a la representación de las misiones oficiales o embajadas, que suelen tener la tendencia de adoptar posiciones partidistas de defender a los gobiernos, las políticas de los gobiernos, olvidándose de las voces de los congresos, de las instituciones judiciales y, desde luego, de las organizaciones civiles y, sobre todo, en nuestro caso, de las organizaciones indígenas, ofreciendo información que no contrastan con las organizaciones indígenas y que, cuando nosotros hablamos con las organizaciones indígenas, resulta que esa información es como mínimo inconsistente, cuando no falaz. Y, por lo tanto, celebro que personas como Gloria Ramos, con toda la autoridad que le da su presidencia de una comisión clave del Congreso del Perú, venga al foro a exponernos su visión de hasta qué punto el gobierno de Perú sigue resistiéndose, aunque quiere ofrecer signos de que evoluciona, pero sigue resistiéndose a afrontar los derechos de los pueblos indígenas conforme a los estándares internacionales a los que está comprometido, muy en particular por la ratificación del convenio 169. Nada más, muchas gracias.
Proseguimos con nuestra lista de oradores. La señora Florina López, en representación del caucus de la Via Yala. Señora López, tiene la palabra. Sí.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente. Los representantes de las organizaciones de los pueblos indígenas de Via Yala, presentes en esta novena sesión del Foro Permanente de las Cuestiones Indígenas de las Naciones Unidas, presentamos nuestra siguiente declaración. Señor presidente, los pueblos indígenas, a pesar de los diferentes avances de reconocimiento de nuestros derechos como pueblos indígenas en los diferentes instrumentos internacionales, regionales y sobre todo con la adopción de la Declaración de las Naciones Unidas sobre los Derechos de los Pueblos Indígenas, que contiene el reconocimiento de nuestra identidad, nuestras formas de estilos de vida tradicional, el reconocimiento a la libre determinación, al derecho a nuestro desarrollo desde nuestra propia visión, el derecho al control de nuestros territorios, tierras y recursos. A pesar de estos avances, vemos que aún se sigue violando estos derechos en la mayoría de nuestros países con iniciativas sin el libre consentimiento previo informado de nuestros pueblos, y que destruyen nuestros territorios, tierras y recursos con la excusa del desarrollo. Por lo tanto, le consideramos una agresión directa a nuestros pueblos, animales, plantas, cuando se talan nuestros bosques indiscriminadamente. Señor presidente, especialmente utilizan nuestros bosques para solucionar los impactos del cambio climático global, destruyendo y desplazando a muchos de nuestros pueblos, aumentando la pobreza de nuestra gente e ignorando los impactos directos que sufrimos los pueblos indígenas y la biodiversidad por el cambio climático. A pesar de esta realidad, los estados siguen agrediendo directamente a nuestros pueblos, en especial en la Amazonía, otorgando concesiones para la explotación de los bosques, minería, contaminando el agua, el aire, que significan la muerte y que contradicen con sus iniciativas, con los supuestos beneficios y soluciones para la humanidad, que hoy llamamos planes de medidas de adaptación y mitigación al cambio climático. Por lo tanto, recomendamos lo siguiente. 1. La implementación urgente de la Declaración de las Naciones Unidas sobre los Derechos de los Pueblos Indígenas en todos los procesos e iniciativas de desarrollo de nuestros territorios, tierras, así como el Convenio 169 de la OIT y otros instrumentos internacionales de derechos humanos que se utilizan para el desarrollo de las metas del milenio. 2. El reconocimiento de nuestra soberanía sobre nuestros territorios, tierras y recursos de nuestros bosques, respetando el consentimiento libre, previo e informado de nuestros pueblos. 3. El rechazo de todas las políticas de soluciones falsas, como los proyectos RED, los mecanismos de desarrollo limpio y otros que ponen en peligro nuestros bosques, el sistema de vida, sistemas productivas y reproductivas de nuestros pueblos. 4. Exigir la reparación de los territorios ancestrales de los pueblos indígenas afectados por todas las iniciativas unilaterales de parte de los gobiernos y ONGs, sobre todo la restauración de los bosques, que no solo sea económico, sino de justicia. 5. Apoyo y reconocimiento y fortalecimiento del rol de las mujeres indígenas en la protección y el mantenimiento de la biodiversidad en los bosques. 6. Que se respeten los conocimientos, saberes y prácticas ancestrales y deben ser reconocidas también como medios para solucionar la deforestación, la degradación y fragmentación de los bosques por el cambio climático. 7. Apoyamos la conclusión del Grupo de Trabajo sobre Bosques de la Conferencia sobre Cambio Climático realizado en Cochabamba, Bolivia. Muchas gracias, señor presidente.
Ministro de...
Ministro de Asuntos Indioamericanos.
Indioamericanos de Guyana.
Disculpen, nuestro próximo orador es el señor Ministro de Asuntos Indoamericanos de Guyana. Señor, tiene usted la palabra.
Thank you. My name is Pauline Sukai, the Minister of Amerindian Affairs from Guyana. Excellencies, government officials, indigenous leaders and representatives, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Chairman, the government of Guyana acknowledges the valuable contribution the UNPFII continues to make in addressing issues of importance to indigenous peoples. The importance of the sustainable utilization of forest resources is now a fact that the global community recognizes, albeit belatedly. The major role that sustainable managed tropical forest, inclusive of Guyana's forests, play in providing national, regional, and international benefits, especially in terms of mitigation and adaptation to the adverse effect of climate change at the global level, is receiving the well-deserved attention of the international community. And we are pleased that the Permanent Forum has placed this issue on the agenda of its current session. The government of Guyana has always held the firm belief that the country's vast natural forest and its resources must be used for the socio-economic development of our peoples. It is an essential policy position that our government has maintained since we recognize the critical relationships between the promotion of sustainable human development and the sustainable exploitation of our country's resources. Guyana's forests cover 85% of our country's total land area. At the same time, our Amerindian population occupies and owns some 13.9% of Guyana's total land mass, including important forest resources. Whilst many indigenous peoples globally have only rights of use to land resources, the Amerindians of Guyana have rights to ownership of land by way of legal titles, are in fact the largest private land owners in our country. Integral to the Amerindian people's ownership of land and their exclusive rights to their forest and its resources are the following pieces of legislation: the Amerindian Act of 2006, the Environmental Protection Act 1996, and the Forest Act of 2009, all of which makes provisions for the recognition of sustainable management and use of forest resources. Amerindians also have further opportunities with the access to state forest by virtue of government's policy to grant state forest permits to Amerindian communities. Permit me now, Mr. Chairman, to briefly share with you our country's approach with respect to the sustainable management of our standing forests in the context of REDD+ and the Guyana's low-carbon development strategy, a model which is being promoted both nationally and internationally by our government. In so doing, I wish to mention also that last week, the United Nations Environment Programme presented the 2010 Champion of the Earth Award to our President, His Excellency Bharat Jagdeo. In recognition of his outstanding international leadership on combating climate change and his pioneering efforts on low-carbon economic development, the National Tushaus Council, which is comprised of the democratically elected Amerindian chiefs, has taken a lead role and responsibility to ensure the continued active participation and contribution of Amerindians to the formulation of these important national development initiatives. Such involvement and efforts are expected to result in further raising public awareness among Amerindians and to allow for their studied and considered recommendations, thereby giving full effect to the principle of free, prior, and informed consent. This principle of free, prior, and informed consent is an integral aspect of our country's low-carbon development strategy upon which our country is currently embarking. A framework for opting in is being developed by Amerindians in partnership with government, thus providing established standards that will allow for considered decision-making by Amerindians with regards to consent for the deployment of their forests, if at all. In conclusion, I would wish to allude to the relevance of the message contained in the Amerindian Chiefs' Resolution of October 2007, which mirrors the position of the Bali Plan of Action on REDD+ and the Dialogue on Climate Change. And I quote, "We are also well aware of the role of forests as the lungs of the earth by their absorption of carbon dioxide, which is one of the main contributors to global warming. We therefore call on those who are responsible at various levels in the fight to save our planet from the dangers of climate change to immediately move in a serious way to provide the necessary incentives to encourage good practices and prevent growing threats to forests. This message contained in the resolution of 2007 describes very profoundly the Amerindians of Guyana's understanding of the importance of forests to their livelihood and development. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Señora ministra, muchas gracias. Vamos a seguir con nuestros oradores, pero antes quisiera, por favor, pedirles que seamos generosos con el tiempo. Es importante el debate que tenemos, pero también es importante poder establecer medida al uso del tiempo. Vamos a dar la palabra a la señora Victoria Tauli Corpus, miembro del foro permanente. Señora Tauli Corpus tiene la palabra.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to take the floor to reiterate some points which I haven't done in my earlier intervention. And a few of these points are related to the interventions that were done earlier. First of all, I would like to raise a question related to the people's agreement that was referred to by Mr. Goldtooth, by the ambassador of Bolivia, among others. And I would like to look at the statement in page 5 of the agreement, says that we condemn market mechanisms such as RED, reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, and its version plus and plus plus, which are violating the sovereignty of indigenous peoples and the right to prior, free, and informed consent, as well as the sovereignty of national states, the customs of peoples, and the rights of nature. I would like to get some more clarification about this, because if I read this as it is written, what this is saying is that you are condemning market mechanisms such as RED, which violate the sovereignty of peoples. So would this mean then that if there are RED mechanisms which respect the sovereignty of peoples and which ensures that the right to free prior informed consent of peoples as well as of their customs, if there are such schemes, are you still going to condemn this? This is a question that I would like to raise, because I think it's important for us to know exactly what is it that is being condemned. No, because as far as I know, and I have been closely engaged with the negotiations on RED, there is no RED being implemented up to now, because the agreement has not yet been concluded in Copenhagen, and therefore the stage of implementation of RED is more on the RED readiness aspects, which is involving the setting the countries to be prepared to be able to do RED, no? And this is the situation presently. Those which are existing up to now are basically in this readiness phase, and it's not really any full-scale implementation of RED, no? If you look at the agreements reached in Copenhagen, that agreement has not yet been concluded, because it has been trumped by the Copenhagen Accord, which has been agreed by 27 heads of states, no? And the process of negotiating this is still going to continue until Cancun. And secondly, I would like to stress that indigenous peoples in various parts of the world who are taking steps to get engaged with this, I think are mainly concerned and are mainly interested in using RED to really push governments to reform their laws and policies regarding forests. As I mentioned in my earlier intervention, the situation of forests for a long time has been terrible for indigenous peoples, ranging from the colonial policies up to the Tropical Forest Action Program, up to all these lagging schemes that are being done. And
it has been forgotten for a long time that indigenous peoples are really the ones who have been protecting these forests. And therefore, what indigenous peoples in many developing countries are trying to do is to use this opportunity to challenge the governments to really reform their laws to respect the rights of indigenous peoples in their country, as well as to protect the rights of indigenous peoples to continue protecting their forests. And so this is really where they are coming from. And I think indigenous peoples in those countries have really thought about this. They have discussed it with their elders, with their traditional authorities, before they have decided to engage with this. So I would like to raise this issue because I think, you know, the indigenous peoples who are engaging with this kind of process just to push for better opportunities for them to get their rights recognized, to ensure that their forests will not be deforested, and to ensure that their traditional knowledge are going to be respected by the governments, have thought about it and are really discussing it amongst themselves. No doubt there are lots of controversies, but as a member of the Permanent Forum, I think my mandate is to ensure that the rights of indigenous peoples to assert their right to self-determination, to assert the right to decide what should happen in their territories and in their communities, is first the basic principle upon which the Permanent Forum bases its whole existence. And I think that right has to be respected unconditionally. And that's the point that I have been trying to stress in many of the discussions. And finally, just to say that that in relation to the market mechanisms and the carbon markets, I think indigenous peoples have clearly said that they would rather not use their forest as a source of carbon credits for the developed countries to use, not to implement or not to meet their obligations. I think we all agree that that is not the main means by which the Annex I countries should meet their obligations or commitments as parties to the convention. The demand of indigenous peoples is that the Annex I countries should first and foremost cut back their emissions in their own countries and not rely on getting credits from the developing countries. And I think that is a clear statement that indigenous peoples have done. And we should really support that, because that is what the Climate Change Convention is all about. We don't like that the Climate Change Convention authorizes or gives a license to these rich countries who have caused the problems in the first place not to meet their obligations at their home front and meet this by buying carbon credits in the developing countries. Therefore, the issue of carbon using forest carbon in the trading mechanism, I think, is something that we all agree on. And the last point I would like to make is in relation to the market mechanisms. I hope we are just referring to the market mechanisms in the convention, because I think indigenous peoples are not fundamentally against the market. Indigenous peoples have been using the market. They have been trading with each other. The Inuit brothers and sisters have been trading fur with other countries. So we do use the market for as long as the market is in our control. Of course, if we have local markets where we trade with each other. So I think it's not an issue of being against the market per se, but being against the market which provides or gives more control to the rich corporations as well as the rich countries. Thank you very much.
Gracias. Invitamos a nuestra colega Margaret Lokawa a hacer sus comentarios.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I would appreciate all the speeches that were given by our speakers concerning forests and indigenous peoples. I think there was a very clear message put across. Our observation is that the issue of red is becoming contentious. Some indigenous peoples are pro-red, some are against red. And I think the main point here is maybe people have not understood exactly what red means, and this calls for, you know, the kind of maybe sensitizing people, letting them know exactly what it entails or what red is or what red plus is. Now, the other issue, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to raise up is the involvement of women in this participation of the negotiations going on. You know, this is the only way people can understand so many terms. Perhaps the word red is new or something. So there is a need to have great participation of women and also other indigenous peoples in these processes. And I'm happy we had one of our delegates from the UN Red. Maybe those could be some of the options or some of the ways we could enable our people to participate in this kind of negotiations. The other one I wanted to point out, Mr. Chairman, is the financial support to indigenous peoples in forest management. You know, because of this global crisis, especially arising from this, you know, climate change phenomena, indigenous peoples have had a lot of challenges in terms of finance, you know, to manage some of the resources to manage their forest system. And then the other point I wanted to raise, Mr. Chairman, which is not on the red, is the issue that I wanted to raise this afternoon concerning the issue of TB, which has become one of the issues facing our people. Now, TB control, when done well, is an example of a successful public health intervention that can serve as a stabilizer for strengthening overall health systems. It is well accepted that where TB is a major problem, health care systems are poorly functioning and often non-existent. The control of TB requires a number of basic components that one has the right to expect from any health care system, specifically access to health care, trained community workers, nurses and doctors, good diagnosis, appropriate treatment, ongoing data collection and analysis. This right to an effective health care system is a right that is often denied to indigenous peoples. The presence of TB is a marker of human rights infringement. TB is curable and inexpensive to treat. Chairman, I am alarmed at the rates of TB in our indigenous peoples and recommend two actions. Two, that the WHO Stop TB Partnership support on indigenous peoples' focal point person who can begin the essential work of engaging indigenous communities and national TB programs. And at next year's UN permanent session, regions report on their disaggregated TB rates, highlighting countries where indigenous access to health care is adequate, and identify nations who require changes in their health care systems to ensure that all indigenous peoples enjoy the right to be free of TB and the right to good health. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias a usted. Vamos a seguir con nuestra lista de oradores. La señora Laetitia Sobel, de Programa de las Naciones Unidas para el Medio Ambiente. Señora Sobel, tiene la palabra.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente. UNEP is actually very pleased to provide this particular session on forests with more background and insights on a particular project, a forest restoration project that it has been involved in. Namely the Mau forests of Kenya that Mrs. Tauli Corpus referred to her in her earlier intervention. This statement here will provide you with information on the support provided by UNEP to the government of Kenya in addressing the degradation of the Mau forest complex, which is one of the most important water towers of Kenya, and as well in promoting the rights of the Ogiek, the indigenous peoples of the Mau forest. Originally, indigenous hunters and gatherers, who are until today a forest-dwelling indigenous community residing in the Mau forest ecosystem. For your information, Kenya remains currently with 1.7% of forest cover in the entire country. The Mau Forest Complex forms the largest forest ecosystem of Kenya, covering approximately 400,000 hectares. Over the last two decades, the Mau, though, lost approximately 25% of its forest cover due to forest excisions, irregular settlements, and encroachment. In order to address the wanton destruction of forest in the Mau and mitigate the negative impacts on environmental stability, economic development, human well-being, and security, the government decided to engage all the stakeholders, including all relevant government ministries, to provide a sustainable solution. A stakeholder consultative forum comprising more than 300 persons representing government, members of parliament, private sector, community-based organizations, local and national non-government organizations, as well as international organizations, was held already in July 2008. The forum was organized by a steering committee, and UNEP, as a member of the steering committee, was instrumental to ensure that the OGIC were given two opportunities to address the one-day forum at that time. The forum was attended by the Prime Minister and 10 cabinet ministers, and the forum endorsed the establishment of a multi-stakeholder task force. Soon after this meeting, the government established a task force on the conservation of the Mau Forest Complex. The membership of the task force included representatives from all ministries and from the most affected communities, the Ogiek, the Kipsigis, and the Maasai, private sector and non-governmental organizations. The mandate of the task force at that time was to formulate recommendations to the government on an effective management structure to stop any further degradation of the Mau Forest Complex, b, providing for the relocation of the people who are residing in the forests, and c, the restoration of all degraded forests and critical water catchment areas in the Mau Complex, and d, mobilizing resources to implement the above-mentioned objectives and secure the sustainability of the entire ecosystem. At the request of the government of Kenya, UNEP led the secretariat of the task force, and the report of this task force was submitted in March 2009. It was approved by the cabinet and the parliament in September 2009. One of the most contentious issues that the task force addressed concerned, of course, the land ownership. The task force, therefore, established a committee to build consensus on land ownership matters. Two representatives of the Ogiek community were members of the committee, and the secretariat of the committee was provided again by UNEP. In this report, the committee stated, and I quote, "The Ogiek, who predominantly inhabited the Mau Forest Complex from time immemorial, have aboriginal title over the Mau as their ancestral land. They therefore claim interest in land within the Mau in the context of being Kenyans and the fact that the colonial powers did not recognize the rights of the Ogiek to their ancestral land, as was the case with other Kenyans who were granted rights over their respective reserves. The post-independence regimes did not either recognize Ogiek land rights. The Ogiek did not extinguish their land rights within the Mau and hence subsists." Unquote. The committee agreed by consensus on a set of recommendations to address past irregularities in land allocations to the Mau that led to the dispossession of the Ogiek. These recommendations were later adopted by the task force and form part of the task force report adopted by the cabinet and parliament. The successful outcome of the committee derived from extensive efforts by the chair and the secretary, UNEP, in assisting to gather the required information and build consensus among the members. In line with this Mau task force recommendations, an interim coordination secretariat was established in the office of the Prime Minister, again in September 2009. The secretariat comprises senior officers from all the ministries, technical advisors from academia, international organizations and non-governmental organizations, as well as experts. And at the request of the government of Kenya, UNEP agreed to provide technical advice on the interim coordination secretariat, whose mandate is to A, coordinate the implementation of the recommendation of the earlier mentioned task force recommendation on the conservation of the Mau Forest Complex, and B, develop the framework for long-term measures to restore and sustainably manage the Mau Forest Complex and other water towers. In order to engage the Ogiek community in the rehabilitation of the Mau, including securing the long-term future of the Ogiek community, the Secretariat embarked in a process of establishing an Ogiek Council of Elders. UNEP was also instrumental in the establishment of that process. Indeed, UNEP has continuously advocated for a transparent and participatory communication strategy with the OGIC. It was during the last year's IASG meeting held in Nairobi in September 2009 and after discussion with members of the ISG that UNEP initiated a strong outreach to the government of Kenya to ensure the OGIEC participation in the rehabilitation of the Mau Forest Complex. The OGIEC Council of Elders was officially launched this month, 1st of April 2010, to address the forest-dwelling communities and indigenous people's concerns. This followed several months of extensive consultations and preparation with the OGIEC community, including two major workshops with the elders and elites and meetings with the OGIEC communities in all areas in the Mau where they're residing. And those includes all the 21 clans of the OGIEC. They're all represented in the OGIEC Elders Council. This historic development, which has been spearheaded with UNEP's advice, marks the very first time the indigenous community with attachment to the Mau Forest Complex has formed its own leadership structure representing various forest blocks to work directly with the government through the Interim Coordinating Secretariat. The mandate, let me read the mandate of the OGIEC Council of Elders. It is to nominate members to represent the Council in the Committee on OGIEC Matters of the Interim Secretariat to address issues related to the... Yes, I'm almost done. Assist the Committee on OGIEC Matters in the establishment of an OGIEC register based on lineages, coordinate the OGIEC community position on issues related to the Mau Forest Complex, and assist the Committee on OGIEC Matters in the development of proposals for resettling the OGIEC communities. And I just want to mention this. There have been no relocations or resettlement of OGIECs as to date, because any resettlement discussions will take place only with the OGIEC Elders Council, and first meetings have yet to be taken place. I will provide you with a full text of my statement, where you have additional information. And I just want to add one more thing: is that UNEP is very much engaged in the fundraising, together with the U.S. government and other donors, towards ensuring the financial backup of this whole initiative. Thank you so much for your time and your attention.
Gracias a usted. Ahora vamos a pedir al señor Tom Goldtooth a responder a la pregunta que se le ha hecho, pero también le rogamos que pueda usar un tiempo bastante corto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking for my other colleague as a speaker, Pavel, but he abandoned me up here. That's a good question that Vicky has asked, and it's a very appropriate question to seek clarification on the intentions and the conclusions related to that that section of the People's Accord. There was a lengthy discussion. In fact, this discussion was 2.5 days, a very intense debate and deliberation by many different people. And like I said, the makeup of the people in this working group was about 70% indigenous peoples. There were representations from indigenous organizations such as KANAI and other organizations in Bolivia. But through lengthy discussion, there was recognition that indigenous peoples from different regions are looking at participating in these RED initiatives once they get implemented. We recognize that there are indigenous peoples participating on advisory committees to develop, within the readiness program, developing policies. And we talked a lot about the self-determination. And so after a lengthy discussion and looking at the bigger picture, how capitalism actually plays a strong part, with creating this climate crisis. There was a lot of debate of socialism, a lot of debate of capitalism and other governmental mechanisms, but the focus was on capitalism and the role that it plays with extracting resources from Mother Earth. And we balanced that with other working groups such as the rights of Mother Earth, the rights of nature. We communicated with the carbon working group, financial working group, and indigenous peoples as much as we could. But in drafting this statement, there was recognition that in the outreach that's been being conducted by a lot of NGOs, such as Conservation International, Environmental Defense Fund, Nature Conservancy, and many other large bingos, big international NGOs who are promoting RED in our communities, who in fact have hired indigenous peoples to work with them, salaried by them, that still a lot of the people are not familiar with what RED is. Some are even more confused. So the issue of free, prior, and informed consent was very critical, that, you know, in any of these discussions that people have to have prior information, thorough information, and it's such a complex issue that there needed to be the lifting up that FPIC has not been, the standards of FPIC have not been recognized, and that violating the sovereignty of peoples was very a big issue as well. In market, in carbon market, we're talking about carbon market initiatives, and it's not just RED, it's other carbon sink initiatives under the Kyoto Protocol, for example, clean development mechanisms, hydro dams, or other initiatives that are part of the market, carbon market mechanisms. So we were limited and challenged with trying to condense language. So it resulted in this brief paragraph. But there was a strong opinion that we're talking about RED, you know, implementate the way it's being developed and eventually implemented, like what was said. There is debate right now on what the financial mechanisms of RED will be, whether it's going to be based around a carbon market system or voluntary public funding. As you heard in the intervention by Mr. Pablo Salón, is that the People's Accord is looking at non-carbon market funding resources, what was mentioned earlier, and that those funds should come from the historical ecological climate debt of the North. Just a real quick comment. I know you wanted me to be brief. I've been working on these carbon issues, climate issues, for over near 10 years, and we have to be pretty clear on the terminologies that we're using when we're saying that RED is a mechanism for conservation of the forest, which is a major contributor to climate change. But the concepts of carbon sinks are particularly problematic because confusing fossil carbon that's in the ground with biological carbon results in these carbon sinks being phantom reductions, which do not actually address the problem of climate change. Very important. The carbon dioxide molecules resulting from deforestation may be chemically identical to those coming from the burning of fossil fuels, but climatologically they're different. So the carbon released from deforestation does not increase the total amount of carbon that's being exchanged in the atmosphere, the oceans, the soils, but the carbon released specifically from fossil fuels is the one that we need to tackle head on, that carbon pool. So that's why we're in a dilemma. We have to be clear that the whole RED initiative was created not really to address and mitigate climate change. In fact, the numbers of whether it's 20% of contribution to the carbon going into the atmosphere, like what has been promoted through the international negotiation, has actually been proved to be false. It's less than 20%. So that's why there's a lot of concern when we talk about carbon offsets and the mechanisms for this as a tool for addressing climate change, because it ends up not adding up. So carbon offsets, you know, are the environmentally equivalent of financial derivatives, complex, unregulated, it's unchecked. So that's my final comment. Thank you.
Gracias, señor. Hemos tenido uno de los debates más intensos. El tema, como se ha dicho, es muy complejo. No hay información disponible o el acceso a la información no es tan fácil. Hay muchos hermanos, muchas hermanas que no conocen sobre el asunto y hay esta voluntad de diálogo entre expertos y delegados indígenas. Eso es muy bueno. Vamos a seguir con este debate. Hemos escuchado al último orador de nuestra lista y el foro permanente continuará con el examen del tema 7 del programa en su 14ª sesión, que tendrá lugar el jueves 29 de abril del 2010 a horas 10 horas en la mañana. Se levanta la sesión.